From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 172 and the second part of my Carnivore 101 with extraordinary woman Amber O'Hearn. If you missed the first part, do go back and check it out. But otherwise, let's jump straight back in where we left off last week with our nose to tail topic. What about other things? You know, is it a problem if you just eat muscle meat? You know, what about other things that you get from other bits of the nose to tail? You know, I'm thinking of, things like collagen. I'm a great fan of eating. I love all the skin. That's always my favorite bit on almost every animal. I love pork crackling and I love chicken skin. And I don't know whether, part of that is perhaps my body needs it, wants it, and why I like it so much. Who knows? But what about all those other bits and pieces? Is it a problem if all you eat is ribeyes?
It's hard to say. I mean, collagen in particular, one thing about all you eat being ribeyes that people don't necessarily think about is that your serving size goes way up compared to a more mixed diet. So the amount of anything that you would find in a serving of meat, your serving size goes from one small part of your diet to your whole diet. Mm. So you might be eating, it's not uncommon for carnivores to be eating somewhere between 1.5 and 2 pounds of meat a day. And so if you look at something like collagen in particular, the amount of collagen that you get just in muscle meat from the tissue is actually quite significant. It's like as much as you might get in a supplement in some cases.
Okay.
And then there's also different extremes of eating the same thing. So you say muscle meat on the one hand could include some pork and some chicken and seafood and different things that are all technically muscle, but are going to have variety in the nutrient profile. And then you can let in so far as you believe that your body tastes are going to steer you toward the things that you need more. If you just follow your natural hankerings, like, oh, wow, I really today I just feel like having some mackerel or sardines, and other days I'm more drawn to beef ribs or whatever it is, that may be enough to get you that variety. And if you're talking about just ribeye, that's definitely a lot more restricted. And I think it's hard to say what the very long-term effects are, but I think we have enough people who have been doing carnivore diets for at least several years to say that it doesn't seem to be detrimental in the medium term. Mm. the only really in-depth clinical study that we have, actually, we have a few, but they're all more or less case studies for carnivore diets. There's the very old study from the late 1920s where Stephenson and Anderson both, they had been Arctic explorers and they had claimed that they felt better than they ever had in their lives when they were eating with the Inuit. And this was contentious in their circles. And so almost on a kind of like, yeah, well, I'll prove it to you then kind of situation, they agreed to go into a hospital setting and do a study where they spent the first couple months in hospital and then spent the rest of it out for the course of a year and were monitored for things like deficiencies and in fact none turned up. But they were not eating just ribeye. They were eating organs, for example, and probably not just liver. So there's that data point. And then there are also some data points from the paleomedicina group who have also put patients on carnivore diets. But again, that is a situation where they are very deliberately including a lot of different meats, nose to tail, with different organs and very high fat. So in terms of what we know and what we don't know, we're really just at the tip, the very tip of having any kind of knowledge. And so if you go ahead and try a carnivore diet and you say you try it for 30 days and you find, oh my goodness, this really does make me feel better and put some condition that I was struggling with to bed. And now I know that I really want to do this. Now you're in a position that I'm in and that many others are in that has this disadvantage that we really don't know the long-term consequences. And all I can really say about that is that one of the best determiners for health into old age seems to be the health that you're in mm-hmm. now, right? Mm-hmm. So if something you do makes you healthier in the present, that is usually a good indicator that it's going to make you healthier into the future. But we really have...
Yes, why would you think that it wouldn't have good long-term benefits if it's having good short-term benefits? I mean, I guess, you know, sometimes that's the case, but it seems it's odd how often you hear this really weird from doctors, for example. You know, I heard recently somebody was talking about how their child had been doing so much better. It was epilepsy, I think, been doing really a lot better on a ketogenic diet. And so they're doing really well. So, you know, so now we should stop it and do something else. Why on earth would you stop something that was working really well for you? Because you had some idea that it, I guess, is the reasoning behind it, is that you have some idea or fear that it's going to be bad for somebody long term, even though it's dramatically improving their health in the here and now. Those things just, they don't gel for me. It doesn't, the logic of it doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, the best kind of steel manning argument that I could come up with, things that I've heard that have some kind of sense. One is that there's some kind of long-term deficiency going on that we don't have a way to measure. So you're gradually being depleted of something.
Yeah.
And suddenly later.
Yeah, suddenly going to come and bite you. Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of thinking. I guess in the epilepsy case, it used to be that children put on a medicalized ketogenic diet were also very highly restricted in protein, and that was demonstrably affecting growth negatively.
Right.
Fortunately, it's been discovered that almost everyone who gets a benefit from a medicalized ketogenic diet for epilepsy also seems to be able to get a benefit from a more liberal, modified Atkins-style diet where protein is not restricted. I phrased that really badly, saying that everyone who gets a benefit from this will get a benefit from that. It's not that we've tested everyone, but we have tested modified Atkins diet, and the benefits seemed to be the same in almost all cases that were studied. And interestingly, it doesn't seem to depend on the depth of ketosis. I think just being in the state of ketosis in many cases is more important than how much ketosis you're in, which is good news for the carnivore diet, because the fact that it tends to be higher in protein than a garden variety kind of ketogenic diet means that ketosis does tend to be milder. But apparently, for many people, that seems to be enough to get both the benefits of the ketogenic aspect, which I think are quite amazing, and the benefits of the plant avoidance.
And more isn't necessarily better when it comes to ketones. I know certainly from my point of view, if my ketones, you know, there's a sort of upper limit where I have a kind of range that I fall in where I feel at my best, below which I tend not to feel as good, but above which as well, I start not feeling too good, get a bit, you know, twitchy, a bit like, almost a bit like too much caffeine, actually.
Yeah.
But I found with carnivore that it would take my ketones pretty high, actually. So I mean, I guess it depends. And I guess it also depends how long you're doing it for and how these things stabilize over time.
Yes, absolutely. Are there other reasons why we might worry that a carnivore diet would be bad in the long term? I guess one thing that comes up a lot for people that is very hard to swallow is the idea that we don't need fiber and the idea that it might be cancer of the bowel and colon causing in the long term.
And aren't you constipated all the time is the other thing.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, the idea that we've internalized along the way that fiber is necessary for having bowel movements. But fiber is actually a bulking agent in many cases. So the idea that that should help if you were constipated is a little bit nonsensical when you look at it. It clinically, people who have constipation, there are many studies about using fiber therapeutically for people who have constipation for whatever reason, and they're very mixed. There's success in some studies, and there's no success in other studies. And there's even a study where the best result was by taking all fiber away. And in fact, it's more commonly reported that when you start a carnivore diet, you will have looser stools than any kind of constipation. Constipation is, as far as I can tell, a very rare response to a carnivore diet.
People often actually assume they're constipated because they're not having as many bowel movements.
That's a really good point.
But the two aren't the same thing.
Yes. So when you're, a lot of the bulk of stool on a mixed diet actually comes from the, well, fiber is technically you can't digest it. And some of it gets digested by the bacteria in your gut. But then you've got the products of that, and you've got the turnover of all that bacteria, and it actually provides a lot of material that we can't digest. And when you're eating,
it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah. So when you're eating a diet that is almost completely digestible, the amount of residue that's left over is going to be a lot less. And like you said, that's very different from constipation, which is the sensation that there is something there that must be eliminated, and yet you can't. It's too large, or it's stuck for some reason.
When you think about it, I mean, what is it? It's what comes out is a waste product.
Yes.
So again, it's funny, isn't it? When you think about these things, if you're talking about eating a carnivore diet, there's less of a waste product. What does that tell you about what you're eating? you know, that you're using it and that there isn't as much of a waste product produced. So kind of what it comes down to then, if you're talking about that argument, is what you were saying about fiber and how we think it's good. Is it, you know, do we need, it's almost like, do we need to flush our system out with this fiber and something that comes out as a waste product? It's kind of, that's where the crux of the conversation comes to. Do we, you know, do we need this waste product going through our system or not? Or is it better just to be producing less of it?
Right. It definitely, you can think of it as giving more workload to the colon. If you think about other animals who are carnivorous in the wild, do we think that their colons are adversely affected by not having fiber? I don't think so. One of the mechanisms that people talk about when they're talking about the benefit or putative benefit of fiber is butyrate, which is a short chain fatty acid that is produced in the gut. So what happens to fiber? Like I said, we can't digest it. No vertebrate can digest fiber, but we have in our guts a microbiome, a host of bacteria and different microbes that actually can digest fiber. And it's a symbiotic relationship. But what happens is they take that fiber and consume it, and their waste product is short chain fatty acids, which is something that we can use. And one of those is butyrate. It's actually not the biggest component, but it's the one that people are most excited about, because the colon cells will readily take up that butyrate and use it, and it's considered very important. But the thing to know, one thing to know, is that fiber isn't the only thing that the biome can convert into butyrate. So, for example, there is always a little bit of amino acids that make it through to the large colon, the large intestines, and bacteria will also make butyrate out of those amino acids. There are things like collagen. If you like to bite the end, the chewy end off of your chicken bone, for example, some of that is, it's called animal fiber, chondroitin and collagen, and less digestible bits of the animal parts that will make it through the stomach, not completely digested. And those parts can get converted into short chain fatty acids. In fact, there was a study on dogs where they gave a high fiber diet and a completely fiber free animal only diet and measured the amount of short chain fatty acids, and they were essentially identical. So there's one, just one whole side of that question is a complete myth that you need that plant fiber to get the butyrate. Then another part of it is that, well, the reason that butyrate is, one of the reasons butyrate is so interesting is because there seems to be a problem in butyrate metabolism when you have colitis and when you have cancer. But if you look at the details of what that problem is, it's that the cells are unable to take up the butyrate. And in fact, adding more butyrate at that point isn't necessarily even helpful. So there seem to be a lot of disconnects around the various ideas about why we should worry about not getting fiber for the health of our colons.
Fascinating stuff. And what about the type of meat you're eating? And two things, I find it interesting that a lot of people, especially if they're carnivore for a while, end up eating more and more or fancy, and this is generalized, it's certainly not true for everyone, but find that they're less satiated by things like chicken and pork and tend to stick mostly to things like beef and lamb just because they find them more satiating. They just say, you know, I just can't get satisfied anymore eating chicken, for example.
That's absolutely true. And that was something that was even noticeable in the conversation a decade ago, seemed to happen to essentially everybody. And there are different ideas about it. I think the one that is most prevalent right now would be about the fatty acid profile. And the thing about ruminants is that the fatty acid profile for a ruminant animal like beef or sheep or goat, for example, is very stable, very little changeable based on what they're fed because of the whole extensive process of digestion that they have. Whereas if you give different foods and different fats and to a monogastric animal, a one stomached animal, like pork or chicken, for example, where humans are monogastric, one stomach, we tend to have adipose tissue that reflects what we ate. So if you're eating a high polyunsaturated fat diet, your adipose tissue will have more polyunsaturated fat in it. And the same is true for pork and chicken. And so there's been a lot of criticism about that because there are health concerns about getting too much specifically of the polyunsaturated fatty acid, linoleic acid. It's an omega-6. And a lot of people are concerned that it might not be good for you. And one of the things that it purportedly does is sabotage satiety compared to saturated fat. And there are really interesting theories about why that would be. So that's one potential reason that eating a lot of chicken or pork might not be as satisfying, especially if you're not having dairy alongside of it. Dairy is very highly saturated. And so should all other things being equal, it should increase your satiety unless it's increasing it by some other means like promoting high insulin or something like that. The other reason that might be part of it might have to do with specific nutrients like carnitine. So the reason that red meat is red is in part because of the level of carnitine in it. And carnitine is important for fat burning. And so it's possible that could be a component as well. If you're getting less carnitine, maybe you're less efficient with your own fat. But that's all speculative.
Very interesting. Something you said there just made me think of the next question. And that was going to be, how much of a difference is there between, you know, you, it's another phrase you hear all the time, well, you must eat grass-fed. It's got to be grass-fed. But I'm just wondering, from something you said just then about maybe that it's less important with ruminants because of the way their metabolism works and what the end result is, and more important with something like chicken. It made me think of a conversation I saw the other day. In fact, it was somebody, I think, talking about the lack of satiety they found. They're not, I don't think they're completely carnivore, but certainly heading that way. And they've noticed that that they're not feeling as satiated from chicken in particular. And somebody commented, well, it's important the kind of chicken you have. Go, you know, try a free range, organic, all the things chicken, and you might well find that you find that much more satiating than your typical supermarket chicken. So is it more important with certain meats than other meats about how they've been reared?
Yes, exactly. So there are two things about ruminants and the fatty acid profile. One, like I said, that it's harder to change that profile just based on what you give them. And second, the amount of polyunsaturated fat is really quite low regardless. So some people will advocate for grass-finished cattle, for example, based on the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6. And while it may be true that it does have a better ratio or a higher amount of omega-3 fatty acids, the total amount is going to be so low that it's not clear to me that it really makes a big difference. The biggest difference that I know between grass-finished and grain-finished beef is that typically the grain-finished will be able to get a lot higher fat, especially marbling, and that's important for me. So that's one reason why I do like grain finishing. Whereas, like you said, with pork and chicken, the feed that it's been given actually has a much bigger effect on the final product in terms of its qualities. And so that idea that eating a pasture-raised chicken would give you more satiety is definitely what would be predicted by the hypothesis that I outlined.
Mm. And an interesting thing that I found myself, but I've seen cropping up with other people, and that is they're starting to find that chicken makes them feel a bit sick. I used to eat a lot of chicken big fan of chicken thighs. I've always liked the dark meat much more. And I used to eat chicken thighs very regularly, roast up chicken thighs, you know, with whatever. But it was a regular meal. I probably have it at least once a week. But recently, it started to make me feel a bit sick. And I've started to see posts with other people saying the same thing. And I've no idea why, really. I don't know whether it's something you've seen or something you have any thoughts on, but it's an odd thing that seems to be cropping up.
I hadn't encountered that. And the way you described it, it sounds like you're talking about home cooked. So it's not the first thing that came into my mind was, oh, it's what it's being cooked in. But if you have control over that, then that's not what's happening. I haven't heard that. Mm.
And very plain cooking as well. Yeah, you know, just roasting it in the oven, a little salt maybe, and that's it. So there's nothing else really there to interfere, and nothing that's changed from the way it was cooked before. It's just very odd. And so I hardly eat chicken anymore because it tends to make me feel sick. And weirdly, less so when it's cold than when it's hot. I can't explain it at all, but it's very, very strange.
You know, that could, and this is totally speculating, but it could have to do with the fat. If, I don't know if you find, but I know I sometimes find that it's much more difficult to digest rendered fat than even liquid fat, I guess, more than solid fat.
Yes, yes, that's very true for me. Mm.
If I have a ribeye and it has a large section of fat on it and it becomes very liquid from the cooking, sometimes I have a hard time eating that very gelatinous, liquidy fat. But if I then put that, instead of eating it right away, put it in the fridge and then come back to it when it's solidified again, then I find it very easy to eat. And I wonder if maybe something like that's going on with the chicken for you. If there's a lot of polyunsaturated fat in it, that would make it more liquid than the more saturated fat at the same temperature.
But why should that make you feel sick when it's liquid as opposed to when it's solid?
I don't know.
I don't understand the logic of that. But yes, that's absolutely true, certainly for me.
It might have to do with speed of transit.
Yes, maybe.
Maybe it's not getting digested enough because it's moving through too quickly.
Yes, maybe that makes sense.
But I don't know.
Ah, interesting. And yes, maybe that actually that's making me think of a recording I did a little while back and looking at the fact that I don't have a gallbladder. So maybe it's just me and maybe it's tied to that.
Could be.
So what if people are giving it a go and running into problems? Yeah, what are the common problems people might encounter and what to do about them, even if that might be a good indication to stop what you're doing and go back to what you were doing before?
Well, definitely if it's persistent, going back to what you were doing before is usually a good option if that problem wasn't there, and then at least you can find out if it's repeatable. But I guess it depends.
Well, how long is a sort of a good period of time to kind of push through? Because often when you're making a change, it's the same for keto. People talk about keto flu, which I really don't like as a term. I like carb withdrawal because, you know, let's call it what it is. Often people encounter a similar thing when transitioning to carnivore, especially if they're coming from high carb. But even, you know, going from keto to carnivore, they often encounter those symptoms which are familiar to them often from starting on keto. But, you know, what kind of period of time is it okay to say, actually, we just need to push through this and see what it's like on the other side? And when does that period of time become, well, actually, no, I think we should stop doing this now?
That's a really controversial point to my mind. I mean, definitely if you're coming from high carb, then you should expect all of the same things that you'll expect transitioning to a ketogenic diet in any other form. And I agree that some people do report that when they go from a ketogenic diet to a carnivore diet, they get a sort of echoing of that same kind of adaptation. And maybe it's because they are becoming more ketogenic. If it seems to be the same kind of thing as adaptations that you're familiar with, then I think the same period of time would be appropriate. And keto adaptation, the bulk of it seems to happen within the course of maybe only 4 or 5 days, but there are adaptations, especially that will be more apparent if you're doing a lot of athletics, that can last for several weeks. So the traditional kind of zero carb wisdom from where I learned about it was that you really wouldn't have fully adapted until you'd been doing it for 6 months. But I think, while I agree that that is true, and there may be people who have issues that are not going to resolve until that much time has passed, I also quite empathize that I think about, you know, if I had tried a carnivore diet and I didn't get any benefits, and I'd been doing it for a whole month and didn't see anything but instead had problems, I cannot honestly say that I would have pushed through it, and I'm not sure that I could, in good conscience, advise somebody else to. But in part, maybe it comes back to something that we were talking about in the beginning, and that's the risk-reward ratio. So if you're dealing with something that's really quite serious and you stand to gain a lot if it works, then I would maybe persist longer than I would if, you know, you're just trying it out for a lark to see what would happen, if you'd get any extra benefits, but you're not really in any kind of sickness that you're striving to find a new solution for.
So what are some of the common things that might crop up? And you mentioned diarrhea, and that's something that seems to be something that's very common, that does tend to resolve itself fairly quickly.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. I didn't experience that, but what I did experience was just looser stools. And maybe we should, you know, put a little emphasis on, just as we put an emphasis on the difference between constipation and not needing to go, between just having looser stools and having actual diarrhea are probably quite different. And that does resolve, although I would say my normal happy bowels on carnivore are still not as firm as on a higher fiber diet. And I think I don't think there's a problem with that. I don't see it as a sign of ill health. They were still, you know, well formed. In addition to that, let's see. I think there's a real problem in learning how to eat enough, because a lot of people are coming from a background where they've struggled with weight for a long time and have had to consciously restrict. And they might specifically have worries about eating too much fat. And it's really, really important to eat enough fat or you're just not going to feel well. And it's also important to eat to satiety. There are some rare cases where I think satiety has been messed with to the point that you may need further intervention to get to the weight that you want. But I think for a lot of people, for most people, I would venture, once you start to eat food that's actually going to support your health, it would be counterproductive to try to limit the amount of food from what your body is asking for, even if that amount isn't getting you to the weight that you want. Because if your body's asking for it, you probably need it to support your health. And you may not feel your best if you are under eating. And under eating seems to be a really common problem. And I think that's true for both keto and carnivore, and in part because the ketogenic properties allow you to eat less than you need with less pain. So it's like a well-known phenomenon that you can fast much more comfortably when you're on a ketogenic or carnivore diet, and by the same token, you can undereat much more comfortably. And so I think it's really important to pay attention to that, because in the long term, that's going to cause problems for all kinds of things.
And also, I guess, not to be freaked out if you're finding that you're really hungry, because I've spoken to people who, that's what they're expecting. They're expecting their appetite to go down when they start carnivore, and it doesn't. It does the reverse, and they feel like they just can't eat enough. And for most people who persist with that, it does balance back off. But presumably with this adjustment, it's just a good idea to just listen to what your body's saying. And for some reason, it wants you to eat more meat.
Yeah, and that could be...
Perhaps you're making up for a deficit from a long period of time. We talked about potential cumulative effects. Well, perhaps that's your body's way of rectifying a cumulative problem. You need more of it.
That's right. And especially if you come from, if the diet that you came from didn't contain very much meat, there may be specific nutrients, even just the protein, really, because, you know, protein is so important structurally. It's in everything. It's in your bones. It's in your muscles. And so if your body has been struggling to maintain that kind of healthy, lean mass, and now you're presenting it with an abundance of food that is going to be supportive of those structures, you could imagine, I'm trying to anthropomorphize your body too much, but you can imagine it saying, oh yeah, let's take as much of this as we can because we need it. We've been struggling to keep enough bone or whatever it is. And that could be, you know, if that's the case, and I think that that does happen for people who have been very restrictive, especially restrictive of animal products for a long time. If that's the case, it could actually be reflected in the scale as well. And it might not be a matter of that you're gaining fat, but your weight might actually go up. And that can really freak people out. And I understand why. but if it's a matter of you're gaining lean mass and structure in your body that was needed, then that's obviously something that you want, even if it could even make you feel bigger in the short term. Like imagine if you've gained muscle and you haven't lost fat, that might result in you actually feeling bigger, which would seem like it's the wrong direction. But if you have the fortitude, many people have found that they gained weight initially and then lost weight after some time. I don't think that's the majority case, no. But I've definitely seen it happen. And especially, again, from if you're coming from a very restricted background, it's a real leap of faith to take on a diet to feed your body when you have maintained your health for a long time by, you know, deliberately feeding less than you thought you wanted. And to give up that control can be very, very scary.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes thinking about electrolytes, I know it's a conversation we had and people, I think if it's an electrolyte problem, it's quite easy to identify, isn't it? Things like cramp, Charlie horses, tends to get called in the States, restless legs. I had an eye tremor, for example, and put up with it for ages until I think I had a conversation with you. And I also remembered a conversation I heard that Carl had on the podcast about an eye tremor, and Jason Fung, I think it was, said to him, magnesium. And as soon as I hit it with magnesium, it went away. I mean, I think they're the things that come to my mind as electrolytes being the obvious fix for.
Yes, I agree. Electrolytes are probably the least intrusive kinds of supplements that you can add. You know, often when we talk about supplements, there's this idea that there's no risk to them and only potential benefit. And that's not necessarily really true. A lot of supplements, well, there are certain kinds of supplements where even clinical studies have shown that maybe we shouldn't be taking them. Like I think beta carotene and vitamin E both came under a lot of scrutiny after some trials seemed to show a direction of worsening of health. And the other thing about supplementing with vitamins is that everything's interconnected. And if you're suddenly injecting a huge amount of this vitamin, it may have consequences on the balance in your body that tries to compensate for that, creating further deficits. And then you try to address that deficit, and it can be this almost analogously to using drugs for therapies where you get a side effect and then you add another one to address that side effect. So it's not completely risk-free to add supplements. And in the carnivore community, I think it's quite frowned upon to use supplements because the idea is that you should be letting your body figure that out. I'm not completely against them, though. I think there can be definitely medical reasons, and even just, as you said, like to get back into balance, I can remember early on in carnivore, I took magnesium just to see. I don't remember why I wanted to try magnesium. I don't think I had any particular problem, but I had an experience of a lot of euphoria, actually, for the first week or two that I took magnesium, and then that leveled off. And the way I interpret this, the only way I can really understand this, is that maybe I had had a deficit in my carnivore diet. While it might have enough magnesium on a day-to-day basis to keep you at replete, if you've accumulated a deficit, then really the best way to address it is to give yourself as much of that nutrient as you need.
Yes, and sometimes that's just the case, isn't it? It's just redressing the balance. It's not necessarily then something that you've got to carry on taking. Sometimes you just need to balance those scales out again and fix the problem in the short term.
Mm-hmm. And then there are other things that, you know, there could be a reason why there is a drain on your magnesium that may actually need to be addressed long term. And it could be some medical condition that you've had for a long time, or something genetic, or who knows? I mean, I don't know. I think nutrition is so complex. The more that I study it, like often happens, I think, the more that you study something, the more you realize that you don't know. And there's just so much complexity. It's very humbling. And I would like to think that, you know, just eating, you can find this right way to eat. And when you do that, everything will come into balance. And I do think that to a certain extent, that is the experience that I and a lot of others have had with the carnivore diet. But on the other hand, it really doesn't fix everything.
No.
And so we don't want to find ourselves in a kind of fallacy about naturalism, where we think that this is the only thing that we should be doing to address health, and that if it doesn't fix everything, that you've done something wrong with your diet. Sometimes it's just not the case.
And I think it's interesting that one of the biggest benefits you found from it is the impact on your mood. But that was really the reverse of what I found, and that my mood really tanked when I tried carnivore and went really strict. And it's something that you suggested, and I think this is maybe just the last point to talk about, is the potential importance for some people of the protein to fat ratio, because that might have been, I think, for me, the missing element. And it's something I made a note of when we were talking about butter and my insistence about removing butter because I wanted to remove dairy. So I was not only wanting to dive right into carnivore, but I set myself with very strict rules. So, you know, it was just meat. I did include bacon, I seem to remember. So some processed meat and eggs and salt. But I cut out all plant materials, including coffee. And I insisted on cutting out dairy as well. So my beloved butter went. And I'm used to making, because I had to stop eating scrambled eggs, because I'm used to making scrambled eggs with lots of butter in, and it just didn't taste right with any. I tried all other kind of fats and it just didn't work. So I ended up having to have fried eggs instead, because yeah, it just didn't work without the butter. And I'm wondering, and it's something that you suggested when I've spoken to you about this, and that I really suffered from, instead of my mood improving, absolutely went the other way and actually kicked off a very long period of depression. Although that might be conflated potentially with menopause, I don't know. Looking back with hindsight, I think the two things might have happened together, because I also experienced a lot more hot flushes. So I wonder if it's sort of, you know, ramped up that period of change as far as menopause goes, and that had an impact on my mood as well. I don't know. But it's just a point that I wanted to bring up, that if you do find that your mood is going down, perhaps you need to look at the protein to fat ratio.
Yeah, there are several times where the protein to fat ratio might become important. So when you're going to a carnivore diet, it's very common that your protein levels will go way up. And if you're already eating enough protein, that might not necessarily be a complete win, because it'll change the hormonal response to your food. So on a low carb diet, there's always going to be some percentage of your calories that are coming from actually carbohydrates, and it might only be 5 or 10%. But when you go onto a carnivore diet, that might be getting more replaced with protein than with fat. That may or may not make you less ketogenic. Protein's definitely less of a barrier to ketosis than carbohydrate is. And I like to emphasize the fact that you can actually often eat more protein for the same level of ketosis on a carnivore diet than on a low carb diet, exactly because of that. But at the same time, it's not without limit. And a lot of people are much more sensitive to the level of fat that they're getting and the level of ketosis that they're getting from their diet for the benefits. I think that for some people, the benefits really have a lot more to do with plant removal, and they may not have very much metabolic issue with different levels of protein to fat, and that might have to do with metabolic syndrome status. I think that people who are pre-diabetic or who have resolved or are resolving diabetes by a low-carb diet may be much more susceptible to detrimental effects of too much protein than someone who doesn't have that background. Mm. And definitely fat levels have the potential to provide the backbone for different hormones and like sex hormones and cholesterol, for example, that will be important for mood and maybe even there could be a connection to your experience with a return of menopause symptoms that actually could have been from being less ketogenic than you were on your previous diet. So a lot of people are experiencing better results when they combine this carnivore idea with the therapeutic level of ketosis idea. And it really does entail having to eat a lot more fat. And it turns out, I think, to be a lot harder from a social perspective and from just an enculturation perspective to eat fat when it's coming from animal than coming from plants, because there are a lot of fat sources from plants that are just kind of normal in our diet, especially I think salad oil and maybe nuts and things like that, that are no longer going to be able to provide that. And if you don't embrace the higher levels of fat, for some people, it's just not going to work as well.
Yes. And of course, that's where butter comes in, because in general, it's highly palatable. It's quite easy to eat a steak, for example, with butter on top of it, or to put lots of butter in your scrambled eggs. It's a lot easier usually than adding, you know, some lard or tallow, for example. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned back at the start, that it can be a very useful product to use if you do feel that you need to be adding fat when you're eating carnivore.
Absolutely.
Just because it's tasty.
Yes. Eggs, if you can eat them, like you mentioned, they will take up a lot of fat. So the scrambling eggs is one of the easiest ways, I think, on carnivore to increase your fat intake without it feeling like you're guzzling fat in a way. But you might, if butter is something that you think you want to avoid, but it's more of a gradation, you might find that a little butter with a bunch of tallow in eggs might go a long way to just get the flavor profile right without it being the only fat.
Mm, yes, good point.
Might be something to try.
Mm, yes, that is a good point. And you did mention about fasting and carnivore, and it was a question that was raised when I asked my Patreon group if there was anything particular to ask you. And the question that came up was fasting, that they'd seen in groups that it was recommended that you didn't fast as well as being carnivore. And other people were saying that they struggled to fast more when they were carnivore as opposed to keto. Is that quite a typical thing? And is there a reason for it? Or it's just an individual?
Fasting has been anti-recommended in carnivore groups in part because a lot of the people who were drawn early to the carnivore diet were people who had a sort of disordered relationship with food and calorie restriction that it seemed to people in the group, it was more important to learn how to eat enough than to focus on rapid weight loss.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
And that fasting for certain people was contributing to an inability to let the food heal you itself. I did mention about how the two, I think, biggest benefits of fasting are already achieved on carnivore. You're removing all these inflammation-inducing foods, and you're allowing yourself to be ketogenic if that wasn't part before. And those are really the two biggest things about fasting. And so in many ways, fasting becomes superfluous when you're on a carnivore diet. That said, I definitely have spoken to Megan Ramos from the fasting clinic, and she has seen cases for sure where people who were on a carnivore diet got additional benefit from some kind of therapeutic fasting regime. And I don't doubt that at all. About people having a harder time fasting, that just seems to me like it would be another reflection of being less or insufficiently ketogenic, such that when you try to fast, you're actually on more of a glucose-based metabolism and you're expecting more food. That would be my first guess as to why that might happen. And so, again, the way to test that would be try eating a deliberately higher-fat carnivore diet such that you are sure that you're well into ketosis, and then see if the same thing happens. And I would not be surprised if that would be the source of the problem, if it would go away when you did that.
Ah, very interesting. So I think we've probably covered all bases. Is there anything we haven't brought up that you would like to mention when it comes to carnivore, other than maybe to give it a go?
I don't know. That's a great question. What else do people typically struggle with? I think the biggest struggle for a lot of people is the social aspect. Because once you're well into a carnivore diet, I think it becomes easy from a physiological perspective. The cravings for other things really go away quite fast. And it's very surprising, I found, and other people have found, once you remove those plants, even if they were a big part of your diet and something you were looking forward to, for most people, the desire to have them very quickly subsides. But it can be embarrassing to be out in a social situation. Unlike, you know, on low carb, your plate kind of looks like it has a lot of variety. People might not even notice that you don't have carbs on your plate. They might, but it doesn't look weird. But when you're eating only meat and you're being very specific about not even having something with spices, it can be very self-consciousness inducing, or it can make you feel deprived if you are used to having some kind of social interaction in which plants are involved. Since we have so many things about food.
Yes, I remember the awkwardness of it, actually, when I was doing my carnivore challenge. I did go out for dinner a few times and just felt a bit under attack and had to defend what I was doing.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure what I would say to approach that, because different people have different ways, I think, of dealing with that kind of anxiety. So for me, I'm a very private person. And for a long time, I didn't want anyone to know what I was doing. I just didn't want to have to defend it or explain my out there theories about what might be happening. And so I would tend to minimize it by not going out with people or by maybe just not going into what's happening. And other people, I think, especially if you have people that you trust around you, you can kind of get support by telling people what you're doing, as long as they're not going to concern troll you about it. But I think the best thing for that is to think about it in advance. And if you're doing a carnivore trial, for example, like right now would be probably not the best time to try it for the first time, because we've got holidays coming up and there are going to be temptations and there are going to be things you didn't think of. And so the time to do it is something that you can have control over. And just remember that you're doing it because you want to learn. It doesn't have to be forever. And it's you who stands to gain.
Absolutely. Got one final question for you, and you probably don't have the answer, or it's going to be, well, it depends what COVID throws at us next year. And that's CarnivoryCon. It had to be postponed, of course, in 2020. Are we likely to see it in 2021? I hope so.
I hope so, too. There was a long time when I just felt there was too much uncertainty. And I still feel that we're there at this moment as to when a date would be. But I think that we'll be in a much better position to know within a month or two whether things are going to change substantially over the next few months. And the time that I had been looking at and that I hope will work will be at the end of June, but we don't have firm dates. And the venue had offered me some time in June, and I refused to commit about that. And so I don't know if those dates are still available, but that's what I'm hoping will come through.
Great. So there's potential. And actually, the way things are going, it feels like that it could be a real possibility.
I think so now, too. I feel optimism returning.
Yeah, I do. It was such a fantastic event. I really, really enjoyed it. So I know it's just going to keep growing and keep getting more popular when it can actually happen again. That was such a shame that it, but all sorts of things got postponed for the same reason, didn't they? But
yes.
So it sounds like it's got really good potential. CarnivoryCon 2021. We will keep you posted.
Thank you. And thanks for mentioning that.
My pleasure. Okay, I'm hitting you with this without warning, but we always wrap up this way. Do you have a top tip for us?
Top tip. I should have anticipated it because I know you always ask that. I think the best top tip for carnivore is to keep it simple. And remember that the purpose of a carnivore diet is to find what is bringing you your best health. It's not to follow any particular rule. It's not to be cool by being plant free. It's not to fit anybody else's definition of what a carnivore diet is. It's just to find out what makes you feel the best. And so keep that in mind when you are choosing what you're going to try, how long you're going to do it, and whether or not you are going to go back to anything that you eliminated that you think you might enjoy.
Fantastic. Well, I know how busy you are, and so I've taken up way too much of your time. So thank you very much, Amber. It really has been a very great pleasure.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Thank you very much.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share, and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowomen, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Confucius. Life is really simple, but we insist on making it complicated. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.